Have you ever been visited by the government? Remember, the government are not to be trusted and should be avoided at all costs. They are evil and only have their own selfish interests at heart. Keep up to date with our movements via this secret anti-government radio broadcast. Brought to you by The Revolution.
Hello, and welcome to Bird of the Week. It's a podcast about birds, released on a non-weekly basis. Episode 48, Taxonomy. Okay, guys, you knew it was going to happen eventually, and now we're here. The taxonomy episode. Now, I know. This sounds like a dry topic. Scientific pedantry, you get out of here. But here's the thing. The reason why I love taxonomy is because through it, we can map the bird family tree and see how every bird is related to every other, which is kind of cool. Yeah, I think it's cool.
I am cool.
But there are 10,000 birds. This is a huge subject, and I know we could rapidly descend into technicalities and get lost in the weeds. And I don't want that to happen. I want to keep this discussion high, soaring in the sky with our feathered friends to get that 10,000 foot view. So, what am I offering you today? Well, what I would like to do is define exactly what the study of taxonomy is, how it's done, and why it's important. Leaping from that point, we can then turn to our birds and we will see that taxonomy offers us a nearly complete view of what the Aves family tree looks like. And I'll take you on a little tour, beginning with the dinosaurs, going through the mass extinction event, and then tracing out the different lineages of birds that have arisen from that one common ancestor. At the end, we will see the broad families that all birds belong to, and it will help us to understand a little bit more about evolution and how we have arrived at the staggering diversity of birds that flutter about our planet today. But maybe even more interesting, we will maybe see the limitations of this approach when we meet the one bird that defies all our science and threatens to tear everything down from the inside. So stick around as we talk taxonomy.
Bird of the Week.
Now, the first thing we need to do is define what exactly taxonomy is. Is it a way to tax your anatomy? I wish. No. It's basically a way to classify things, but it's a particular way of doing it. So when we talk about classification using a taxonomy, it means we have big groups which then have sub or nested groups inside them. And this is a really useful way to classify life. So, let's forget birds, only for a minute, don't worry, they'll be back. So let's forget birds and think about a dog. We're all familiar with dogs, there's probably one looking at you right now. I own a cat. Why would I pick a dog? There's a cat looking at me right now. It doesn't matter. Dogs are mammals, right? We all know that. That's the group they belong to. They're a warm-blooded animal that gives birth to live young, which are then nursed on milk produced by the mother. Human, dog, kangaroo, whale, they're all mammals. So that's our dog. Dog's a mammal. But a dog is also a carnivore. They belong to a group of mammals that eat meat, along with lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! Carnivore is a subgroup within mammals. It's one of those cases where all carnivores are mammals, but not all mammals are carnivores. Kangaroo, for example, mammal, but not a carnivore. They're a marsupial. They nurse their young in pouches. But then, finally, dogs are also canines, or, if we want to be technical, canids. Wolves, foxes, coyotes, and whatnot. They're canids, as distinct from other meat-eating mammals like felines, bears, and seals. That's right, seals. Same group as dogs and cats. That's why they're sometimes called the dogs of the sea. And the thing to remember is that everything in one group is more closely related than the things outside it. So, dogs and kangaroos, both mammals closely related. But dogs and cats, both carnivores, in a smaller subgroup, so they're more closely related. You get it. So you can see that with taxonomy, you have groups with subgroups and subgroups and subgroups, and they all just cascade down. Animal to mammal to carnivore to canid. And if we wanted to keep going, we could get more specific groups splitting into a genus that includes wolves and coyotes but excludes foxes, and then another step to define their individual species. And I should also say that taxonomy, it's not exclusive to life. Any system of classification that uses those same principles of a hierarchy of groups can be thought of as a taxonomy. You could use it to classify music, for example. You have a top group containing all music ever made, then you could have a subgroup with rock containing all of its subgenres, classical music and all of its subgenres, rap, folk, choral, you get it. Music can be classified using taxonomy. But we're obviously interested in life, specifically avian life. So okay, thanks to taxonomy, we have a system to classify our birds. But how do we use it? How do we decide which group to put our birds in? Well, my friend, you have asked the million-dollar question. In fact, if you calculated all the time and resources that have been poured into trying to answer that question, it's probably a multi-billion dollar question. And we still don't know for sure if we have it right. The family tree is constantly being updated and amended as new information comes to light. But these days, in the broad, we have a fairly good idea of how the whole thing hangs together. So what tools do ornithologists have at their disposal to make these decisions? Well, the most obvious one is to just look at the bird. What features do they have and how do they compare to other birds? This is called the bird's morphology, and unbeknownst to you, this is something you kinda do without even realizing. Example, you can probably tell if a bird is or isn't a parrot just by glancing at it. Every parrot has that classic hooked beak they use for cracking nuts and seeds. That is a telltale sign of a parrot, and when you see it, you know you're looking at a parrot. Morphology saves the day again! We could then look more closely at our parrot and create smaller groups. For example, some parrots have long tapering tails, while others have short square-shaped tails. A short square tail is one feature that marks the cockatoos as a different subfamily from the other parrots. So using morphological features like these are like a first pass that tell us how birds are related to each other, and the more features they have in common, the more closely related they're likely to be. It makes sense. But of course, this method is not perfect, and there are plenty of pitfalls that can lead us astray. Take, for example, the vultures that live in Africa and South America. They have a lot of similar features. They're big birds of prey, featherless heads, scavengers, and eaters of dead things. For a long time, ornithologists thought they were closely related because they look similar. Turns out, not at all. They are only distant cousins. They're no more related to each other than any vulture is with any other random eagle. The same is true for swallows and swifts. These speedy birds that zip about the sky look remarkably similar, but are totally unrelated. Swifts, as it turns out, are more closely related to hummingbirds, for God's sake. In these cases, the fact that they appear similar is a result of convergent evolution. We've spoken about this before on the show. It happens when unrelated animals that share similar lifestyles independently evolve similar traits. Which is super interesting, that given millions of years, nature can converge on the most efficient body plan. But it does mean that when trying to build an accurate taxonomy, we can't rely on appearance alone. This is where genetic sequencing has been a real game changer. Comparing the genome of different birds has given ornithologists the best insights into the true relationships they share. Of course, there are other ways to do this, but I don't want to overwhelm you too much with all the different species concepts. It's a pretty big subject, and I go into more detail in our How Many Birds Are There episode. Go back and check it out. Today, the main message we need to take away is that we have tools to help us determine how animals are related to each other. And once we have that information, we can begin to build a taxonomy. And have we done that with birds? You better believe we have done that with birds. So where do we begin? I think the best place to begin is with the dinosaurs. Because yes, birds are dinosaurs. Dr. Alan Grant was right that dinosaurs all turned into birds. When the book Jurassic Park was written, that was still a fringe theory. But the facts have backed it up, and today we know for certain that the birds flying around today are the distant descendants of the terrible lizards from hundreds of millions of years ago. Not really lizards. Often these days, when people talk about dinosaurs, they will split them into two groups, the avian and non-avian dinosaurs, because all the others went extinct 66 million years ago. But we'll come to that in a minute. First, we need to know how they got started. So we begin with the dinosaurs. I mean, I guess if we want to do this properly, we should go all the way back to the dawn of life. But you know what? A couple of hundred million years of evolution seems like plenty far back to me. So we begin with the dinosaurs. And first, we have to acknowledge that not every animal that lived back then and looked like a dinosaur was actually one. Pterodactyl, not a dinosaur. Plesiosaur, not a dinosaur. Dimetrodon, those large lizard ones with big sails on their back, not a dinosaur. Turns out they're actually more closely related to people than birds. No, when we refer to dinosaurs, that is a well-defined group that includes only two families. There are the lizard-hipped dinosaurs and the bird-hipped dinosaurs. Let's start with the bird-hipped dinosaurs, so named because they have a pelvic structure that resembles a modern bird's. Seems like as good a reason to name a group of animals as any other. Now, within the bird-hipped dinosaurs, you will find such family favourites as the Stegosaurus and Triceratops. But one thing you won't find, no birds. In a bizarre twist, birds are not descended from the bird-hipped dinosaurs. They are part of the lizard-hipped dinosaur family, which is just, I don't know at this stage, kind of expected, but also just vaguely stupid. But anyway, let's forget those losers that went extinct and instead focus on our lizard-hipped birds. On this side of the dino family tree, we will find other classics, like the Tyrannosaurus rex and the Velociraptor. But you'll note that they are distinct from other dinosaurs in the sense that they are bipedal. They walk on 2 feet, not unlike some more familiar avian creatures we know today. These are the theropods. The word theropod translates loosely as the wild beast with feet. And, you know, I don't think there are many beasts that don't have feet, which, look, I guess that singles them out as distinct from something like a shark? Would we call sharks beasts? Probably not. Doesn't matter. Theropods split away from the other dinosaur lineages during the Triassic period, which was some 231 million years ago. Heavens to Betsy. And for me, I think this is the point where we can say birds began their journey. So our dinosaurs are now standing upright like a bird. The next step was to gain feathers. This brings us to Guliosaurus, probably not saying that right. The majority of the dinos from this group evolved feathers, which originally may have been for warmth or display purposes. Flight would only come along much, much later. We now know that many of the dinosaurs that Jurassic Park made famous, like the T-Rex and the Velociraptor, were feathered creatures. And although it's impossible to know for sure, some scientists speculate that the behaviour of these terrible lizards, not lizards, may have been similar to modern birds. They may have had complex mating rituals. They may have danced for each other, which really goes against the idea of what a dinosaur is for most of us. Hollywood, you can't trust them. Although, if I'm being honest, I don't want dancing feathered dinosaurs in my Jurassic Park movies, so you know what? Good artistic choice. If we continue to travel down the family tree through the millennia, the next major divide in the family brings us to a group known as the Meniraptors. We've now left the Triassic and are in the Jurassic proper. The Meniraptors are like our missing link. They're smaller, more nimble creatures, half lizard, half bird. They were covered in feathers, but many still retained tails, toothed jaws, and clawed forelimbs. From here, they would slowly evolve the power of flight, with the most famous bird precursor, the Archaeopteryx, turning up on the scene about 150 million years ago. They would then spend the next 90 million years slowly morphing into creatures that today we would identify as something that was more or less a bird. And, you know, we can skip over a lot of these obscure, less famous bird-like ancestors, noting just one fun family known as the opposite birds. which, you know, contrary to popular opinion, is not a flying fish, which is what I call flying fish, opposite birds. They're called opposite birds because apparently their shoulder blade bent in the opposite direction to normal birds. So, you know, not really that exciting. But the point is that by the time we get to about 66 million years ago, there was a whole host of different types of birds in a group we call the Euornithes, or true birds. But then disaster struck. Or rather, a hunk of space junk struck the Earth and a big old mass extinction event happened. It wiped out all the dinosaurs and most of our true birds as well. And when the dust settled, only three lineages of bird were left on the dinosaur family tree, and they would go on to become every bird we have today. These are the modern birds, or, if we want to use the language of taxonomy, avies. So that was it, just three lineages of birds. We'll be able to shoot through this real quick. Our oldest, most ancient lineage of bird are the ratites. Ostrich, emu, kiwi, we met them last week. These large, flightless birds were the first group to break away from the family, growing big, ditching flight, and doing their own thing. Of course, just to prove that evolution is a slippery customer, there have been other giant flightless birds in the not-so-distant past, like the terror birds and demon ducks, that superficially at least resemble our more familiar bulky birds. They stood tall, were flightless, and possessed powerful jaws, but they aren't related at all, but belong to other disparate branches of the family tree. As I said before, if we're not careful, evolution can lead us down many a blind alley. Convergent evolution, get out of here! The second lineage that survived the mass extinction event were the fowls, chickens and ducks. This includes all your pheasants and quails, geese and swans. That's a large group of birds, I know. But you might have noticed that I said there are only three lineages of birds that survived the great extinction event. And with the first two, we've covered, what, like 1% of all birds? Yep, every other bird belongs to that third group, the neo-avies, or new birds. Now, this isn't going to surprise you, but things in the neo-avies and how they're all interrelated gets real complicated real quick. So for now, we're going to leave that all to one side and move on, but trust me, this next bit is going to be massively oversimplified. But let's start looking at how the new birds diverged from each other, and we will find about 8 different lineages here. And to make it easy for us to start, there are a couple of birds that are kind of orphans. They're isolated, genetically speaking, from all the other families and belong to their own unique group. Take, for example, the grebes and flamingos. They are each other's closest relatives, which, I know, mind blown, they look nothing at all alike, and yet this one duck-like diving bird and one stork-like wading bird constitute one complete branch of the avian family tree. Another isolated family, the pigeons. Again, they are out there doing their own thing. We've got 2 complete episodes dedicated to the pigeon and how amazing and zany they are, so go and check that out. Our third and nearly final isolated branch belongs to the cuckoos, those baby murdering freeloading parents. They, along with the strange Tarraco and bastards, you heard me, also make up one complete branch. And like, I can kinda understand these birds being out there on their own. When you really dig into them, they all have odd features that you don't find in other birds, which is a bit of a telltale sign that evolution took them down a strange path. For example, flamingos and pigeons, 2 of the only birds that lactate. Pigeons and their close relatives, the sand grouse, also the only birds that can sip water. And as another example, tarracos are the only birds that have evolved a way to produce a green pigment in their feathers. No other bird can do it. Every other bird that has green feathers is using a trick of physics, or colour mixing, to create a green effect. Not the tarracos, though. They have an honest-to-God green pigment. Now, to cover off all the other birds, we have 5 branches left to explore. Next on the family tree are 2 sibling birds, who are like the Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito of twins, the hummingbirds and the nightjars. Yep, those speedy, nectar-feeding, backward-flying birds from South America, and the nocturnal, owl-like birds, frogmouths, nightjars, and pootoos, all belong to the same branch. Yeah, you throw in the swifts and you've basically covered off this clade. These guys are real yin and yang. One side is brightly coloured and active through the day, the other is heavily camouflaged and nocturnal. One side is known for their aerial prowess. The other side is famous for their ability to sit really still. There are some subtle signs that show they're related, though, such as their weak feet and strange tendency to go into a torpor, which is a kind of short hibernation. As you might expect with such divergent birds belonging to the same broad family, there has been a lot of disagreement among ornithologists as to who is in this group and who is out of this group. It's been one of the most reclassified and reorganized branches, so I could go into more detail about how the birds are currently understood to be related to each other, but that will be tedious and probably outdated in a couple of months, so let's move on. Our next main branch is what I'm going to call shorebirds and waders. And now we're getting into the big and more diverse branches. Even though individually there are more hummingbird species, they are all very similar to each other. With the shorebirds, we have more families with more variation. Now, whenever I think of this group, I always think of the seagulls first. I feel they're the better bird for the group. Along with their close relatives, the auks and the skuas, you've covered off about a third of the shorebird family. Wait, has anyone ever noticed how skua is just auks spelt backwards? And skuas are like the evil mirror version of the adorable auks. There's got to be something going on with that. Mysteries for later. The other two groups in this family are the snipes and the plovers. That is, if we oversimplify things and ignore the fact that the crab plover is more closely related to the seagulls. But you know, don't worry about that, we can't afford to worry about it or we will never get anywhere. The main shared features between all these birds arises thanks to the environment they live in. Think of our seagull friends that we find down at the beach. Most birds in this group have evolved for that ecosystem. Things like sandpipers and oyster catchers wade about in the shallows, probing the sand and other crevices for invertebrae. They tend to all be coastal birds, usually not venturing too far out to sea or too far inland. Although, as we know, there are always exceptions. Take, for example, the stone curlew, which is a kind of wader that has evolved to live far from water. Likewise, the skuas have also taken to a life lived mainly out at sea. But if we wanted to find truly oceanic birds, we will have to jump over to a different branch. Over there, we will find penguins, petrels, and albatrosses, along with boobies and gannets, birds that have especially evolved to live life far away from land. But over here, we also find pelicans, ibis, cormorants, and darters, which are birds that we would tend to think of being more shorebirds. But anyway, in one sense, it is nice that at least the majority of oceanic birds and the majority of coastal birds, mostly, with many exceptions, there are always exceptions, belong to two separate groups. Now, there is one more group I want to quickly touch on before we get to the main course, and that is the rails. This is another curious little offshoot. It contains a lot of unusual birds like pufftails and finfoots, which really deserve an episode all to their own. But the two main birds in this group are the rails and the cranes. These are again another watery-based group of birds, but they tend to favour more inland waterways like lakes, rivers, and marshes. We've spoken about rails in detail before when we looked at flightless birds, because funnily enough, they have a predisposition to lose flight, so we won't go into too much detail with them either. But here, we have now reached a point where we have more or less spoken about all of the main branches in the Neo-Aves group, except for one. And after all that ground we've covered, we've met maybe 25% of all birds. There are still a lot left, and they all belong to this one last major branch, or the major branch, I suppose I should say. So as you might expect, it is so big that we really can't talk about it in a cohesive way. So let's begin by breaking it into two groups, the Afro-Aves and the Austral-Aves. Now, I know that name would suggest that these birds are native to Africa and Australia, but you can find representatives from these families all over the world, so don't worry too much about the names. Now, if we begin with the Afro-Aves, we will find most, not all, of the birds of prey. Owls, eagles, hawks, and vultures. are all hanging out down here, Afroavies. But then we will also find their next closest relatives containing a wide array of birds that I like to think of as being a bit beaky. What do I mean by that? Well, we have woodpeckers, toucans, hornbills, and kingfishers. You see what I'm saying? They've all got a lot of beak action going on. The Afroavies have a lot of tropical, colourful birds, like the quetzals and toadies, closely related to kingfishers. Beautiful little birds. But I'm going to skip over a lot of these minor families because we really don't have time, people. But what you've probably gathered is that, once again, it means that the bulk of our birds are still somewhere else and they are all hiding in the Australavies branch. Over here, to start off with, we will find the falcons and the parrots, which is something I always find quite interesting. First, falcons are not closely related to the other birds of prey. They're way off on their own. But a lot of ornithologists have noticed that the most ancient members of the Afro and Australavies are all birds of prey. And this has led some people to speculate that the common ancestor of these two major branches may have likewise been birds of prey. And it also raises the question that if parrots are not so distantly related to falcons, are parrots just the vegetarian version of a falcon? They both have hooked beaks. Maybe. At some point, we will get an individual episode on the falcons and the parrots, so we won't dive too deeply here either. And with that, we have now pretty much covered off all the major families of birds. I have skipped a lot of minor ones. And there is only one family left, the biggest family of all, the family that accounts for half of all living species of birds. It's the passerine or the perching birds. We're talking about something like 4,000 to 5,000 species here, people. Sparrows, finches, wrens, warblers, ravens, magpies, honey eaters, swallows, warblers, flycatchers. We could easily do another episode of the same length to review all the branches and how they're interrelated in this one single family. So I'm not going to do it now. Maybe another day we will come back and do it properly. But I only want to say that the passerines are generally considered to be the most modern and recently evolved family of birds. These birds tend to be small, they tend to sing, and they all have feet with a toe arrangement that is 3 pointing forward and 1 pointing backward. Hence how they got their name, perching birds. Apparently it's just the foot arrangement you want if you want to sit on a branch. And with that, we have more or less finished our tour of the bird family tree, noting once again that I have skipped a lot of the fringe cases and smaller families. But before we finish properly, I want to visit one last bird, because it is the only bird that scientists still have no idea as to where it belongs on the tree. And that bird is called the Hoatzin, spelt H-O-A-T-Z-I-N. Generally, it's accepted as being a very ancient member of the Neo-Avies, and is usually shown shooting off from that group all by itself. The Hoatzin is unlike any bird you have ever seen before. They live along oxbow lakes in tropical South America. They have blood-red eyes, bare patches of blue skin on their cheeks, and a crest of spiky auburn feathers. They have an elongated neck, a really clumsy flight, and kind of look like a punk chicken that lives high in the canopy. Their chicks also have primitive claws on their wings, and if they're in danger, they will jump into the lake and use those claws to climb back up to their nests. And to top it all off, the Hoatzin has a digestive system more like a cow than a bird. They eat highly fibrous leaves that most other animals can't digest. To get around this problem, they have long, complex, multi-chamber stomachs to ferment and break the leaves down. As a result, the Hoatzin has a unique aroma that is said to smell a bit like manure. This has lent them their other common name, the stink bird. So yes, this clawed, cow-like bird is rather a bit different to what we usually get in the bird family. And this has caused ornithologists literal decades of consternation as they try to work out who their closest relatives are. First, we thought they were related to the chicken family. Then we thought it was cuckoos, then pigeons, then shorebirds, then hummingbirds. At one time or another, it was thought that the Huatzin could have been related to pretty much any of the other major bird lineages. But it doesn't seem to fit anywhere, and even genetic analysis conducted in more recent years has only served to raise more questions than it answered. DNA has been one of the greatest tools for ornithologists to finally untangle some of the strange relationships between the birds. For example, it was DNA analysis that finally proved that grebes and flamingos were each other's closest relatives. But the Huatzin has been reluctant to offer up its secrets. What we know is that after the big old extinction event, the Neo-Aves group split off into 8 different lineages, and it seems to have happened really rapidly. We have managed to trace each bird back and group them together into those 8 families, all except the Huatzin. It is possible that it split off at the same time, but travelled through the next 66 million years alone without any close relatives. But at the moment, we don't know enough to confidently place the Huatzin in the family tree of birds. So what does that mean? Is this one bird a one-off aberration? Or does it speak to something more fundamentally wrong with the way we think about classification? Is the system of taxonomy not up to the job? It could be that arranging things into neat family trees with dividing branches and common ancestors is just too neat, as complicated as that system already is. Maybe it cannot accurately represent the true messy nature of life. Maybe we aren't giving bird hybridization enough weight. Maybe early in the evolution of modern birds, genes travelled between families in a more horizontal way. Maybe less of descending down a tree, genes moved sideways. Maybe we should think about evolution happening as more of a network, with genes being shared among different families. Maybe genes don't descend neatly in a linear way. Maybe it's more of a patchwork. It's hard to say. Even with our own human DNA, there are anomalies. For example, even though our closest relatives are chimpanzees, there are some discrete sections of our DNA that are more closely aligned to that of gorillas and orangutans. How can that be? We still can't explain it. Maybe something similar is going on with the Huatzin, but just to a much greater degree. Right now, there is a project going on in Europe called B10K, which is attempting to map the genetic relationships between all 10,000 species of birds. As you can imagine, this is a massive undertaking, and it's already been going for several years. But once it's complete, it will offer us the most comprehensive picture of what the taxonomy of birds and their family tree looks like. Maybe then we will have some answers about this one aberrant bird that doesn't seem to fit. But until then, it stands as a blight, a single fly in the ointment threatening to bring the whole family tree down. But while the tree stands, I hope you have enjoyed this truncated tour of the birds and how they branch off from each other. Over time, we will do deeper dives on more of these families, but I really wanted to just get in there and try to provide a big overview picture. Now, I hope you will join me again next time because we are going to look at the story of Australia's extinct birds. But before then, if you still want some more bird action, I've got some good news. Our bonus podcast called What's Up With That Bird's Name has just come out, and this week it is all about the pit shag. Like, there is so much that sounds wrong about that name, but we are going to unpack it and find out what's going on. And for the low, low price of just $2 a month, you can find out all about it. All you have to do is swing on over to Patreon.com/Bird of the Week, all one word, link in the description to find out more. And if you would like to make a bigger contribution, then you too can get a special thank you from me in the show. Just like my good friends, Jill Chalker, Jody Little, Debbie Ho, Dar Fuller, and Richard Clark, the Minty Fresh. And if you would like to receive a bird in your inbox each week, then drop me a line at weekly.bird@outlook.com, and I will add you to the mailing list where you will receive a new bird lovingly delivered to you for free each and every week. I mean, hey, who doesn't want more birds in their inbox? At any rate, I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and you will tune in again soon. Until then, this has been Bird of the Week. Taxonomy!